This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota as March is ending, perhaps on a good note, weather-wise. At any rate, we're heading toward April, and we're going to start our show today with Jana Gipp. Jana is the CEO of the Standing Rock Service Unit for the Indian Health Service, and she's also a 2019 recipient of a Bush Fellowship. And we've talked to a couple of others who have received this prestigious honor on our show, and we are welcoming Jana Gipp to our microphone in Bismarck now. Jana, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's get a little background information here about where you are, who you serve, and what you do. The Standing Rock Nation is within the reservation, and I suspect some members, enrolled tribal members, live outside the reservation. How many people are we talking about?
Okay, we have about close to 15,000 tribal members, and probably about 9,000 live on the reservation. And I am a tribal member also of the Standing Rock Nation.
And you are the CEO of the Standing Rock Service Unit for the Indian Health Service, which means what?
It means I oversee the healthcare facility that provides direct patient care to our patients on the Standing Rock Reservation and surrounding communities who are eligible for our services.
So this is the hospital at Fort Yates and some other units elsewhere around the reservation?
Yes, we have a clinic in McLaughlin, South Dakota, and we have a satellite clinic in Wakapala, South Dakota, Bullhead, South Dakota, and a satellite clinic in Cannonball, North Dakota.
So how many people are working for the Standing Rock Service Unit?
Approximately 160 staff members.
So this is an important facility for the health and well-being of your reservation.
Yes.
How will the fellowship, this brand new 2019 Bush Fellowship, help you achieve new goals?
The reason why I applied is because I felt like there's a lot of changes nationwide that's going to be happening in the healthcare industry, and there's a lot of legislation coming, policy changes. There's quality of care. There's new, a lot of things new coming about, and I wanted to be able to learn about those things and be able to bring that back to our healthcare system and to the people we serve so that we don't get left behind.
And when you say learn things, you mean you're going to pursue a doctoral program in healthcare administration, right?
Yep, that's one of the one piece of my plan is to pursue my doctorates.
And have you applied and been accepted, that kind of thing?
Well, I have three colleges and or universities I'm looking at, and that decision will be made in the next couple weeks which one I will attend.
You also, of course, have the resources that are available to other reservations, other tribal nations across this United States. Is there some research to be done there as well?
Yes, that's another part of my plan is I would like to reach out to other tribal nations who have successful facilities and see how they are operating, to mentor with people, to start a network, you know, that I can reach out to people when we have with new ideas. And we don't really want to reinvent the wheel because there are some facilities that are successful. We want to see what they're doing and see how we can incorporate that into our facility.
How would you describe the resources available to your tribal members in terms of health care?
We Indian Health Service serves anybody that is a tribal member from any nation. Because it's a federal facility, we serve anybody that is a tribal member, federally recognized, from a federally recognized tribe or a descendant. So we provide, at our facility, we provide direct patient care, outpatient. We have an emergency room. We have inpatient. We have optometry, dental, and behavior health.
Now, in the off the reservation, people typically have some sort of health insurance, whether it's employer-provided or whether it's the Affordable Care Act kind of health insurance. Is there health insurance on the reservation, or is this a service, the Indian Health Service, just afforded to those members who are, you know?
No, they are. We get appropriations from Congress. Appropriations, of course, do not cover all of our budget or all of our operating costs. So we do depend on making sure our patients, if they're eligible for Medicaid or Medicare, we try to work with them to get them enrolled in those services. And we do have patients that have private insurance.
Does the Reservation Health Service assist tribal members who don't live on the reservation?
They do. They can come into our facility if they can show proof of descendancy or proof that they are a tribal member in any federally recognized tribe. They can get services there.
Does the Indian Health Service integrate with health providers off the reservation?
Yes, we have a lot of we collaborate with a lot of services, different places in a lot of areas.
What are the major issues currently facing the delivery of health services to Standing Rock Nation, the kinds of things you would like to make better?
Well, we have there are some cultural aspects of health care that that we would like to incorporate and make that available to our patients that want to have that resource available to them. And I know it's happening on other tribal facilities in Alaska, Navajo, and I would like to reach out and see how that's being done. How is that happening? And because it's successful there, I would like to see what we could do and bring that back to the Standing Rock Nation.
When you say cultural aspects, could you be more specific?
Well, we have ceremonies. We have medicines, and we have plants, and we have things that are available to us in this area that we've used, we have a plant, we have a medicine that we use for headaches or for, there's just a lot of them that we can use, and it's, we can use that, and we can bring it into the Indian Health Service, but I'm not quite sure how to do that yet. So that's part of my plan, is to reach out to those people that have done that successfully and bring that into our facility.
Well, in the back of my head, I'm remembering some of these substances that other tribes have used and might be listed as substances that are illegal off the reservation, like peyote or something like that.
No, we are a federal facility, so we have federal guidelines that we have to follow, so they have to be legal in the United States for us to incorporate them.
Do you have enough doctors to service the people that you cover?
At this time, I'm glad to say that we do at Standing Rock. We have some outstanding providers there. We're lucky because we have five female tribal member. They're not from our tribe, but they are Indian women mm-hmm. that are doctors at our facilities. And they all graduated from UND, and they work with us now. So we, at this time, we have a great provider staff.
So is that the InMed program at UND?
Yes, it is the InMed program.
So it's been proven to be valuable, particularly for your services, I take it.
Yes, it is.
What are the most significant health issues that face Standing Rock's population?
I think that diabetes is a big thing. We are trying to be ahead of the game for the opioid crisis. We are working, our facility is working really hard to manage narcotics that are distributed. So those are some crises that we see that come through, but not to say that we're not dealing with them. We are managing them pretty well.
Now, diabetes, I've heard many times associated with Native American populations. Why is that, do you think?
Because I think that historically, we had a different diet that our bodies were used to, and over time, these other food elements were introduced to us. And to me, it seems like our bodies didn't take that as well. Mm-hmm. Prevention is a very big part of diabetes, and that's one thing that we would like to see. There are some facilities out there that do a lot of preventive work for diabetics, and that's something that we would like to see to incorporate into our facility. I think the other thing that we have a really big issue with is our healthcare facility is old. It was built in 1963, and there's so many changes in regulations and so many changes in requirements and accreditation pieces that our building just doesn't serve our needs anymore.
When you talk about diabetes and this dietary issue, is that a cultural aspect that you might be looking at in terms of getting the word out to tribal members to mm-hmm. consider more indigenous food?
Yes, that's exactly right.
How would you describe the opioid issue on the reservation? Because it's a big one everywhere in the state and across the nation.
Yeah, I believe it's no different than any other community in this whole country. We have, you know, it's an issue for people. Our providers, I can say, take an active, they're actively pursuing other ways to deal with pain by sending people to get massages or do physical therapy to help manage pain rather than giving them pain medication.
Now, every population has older members, and skilled long-term care is a big issue everywhere as well, and I'm of an age where I'm interested in that. How does Standing Rock Nation deal with its older tribal members who may not be able to stay at home?
It's a crisis, as it is across the nation. There's a lack of facilities, and it's really difficult to find care for our older population. We have difficulty reaching out to, sometimes they have to go a long ways away in order to get that care.
So is this something you'll be looking at with your Bush Fellowship in terms of practices elsewhere?
Actually not right at this time, because it's my plan is narrowed to try to bring culture into the facility, and it's narrowed to educating myself to help our facility and our staff become more in tune with all the changes that are coming, and to reach out to those facilities that are successful.
The Bush Fellowship is a two-year program, and it has a significant amount of money tied to it for your needs. What will happen to the position you're in while you're pursuing a doctorate?
I am going to continue to work there.
Wow. That's a load.
I know some people that have done that before, so I think I can do it.
Well, how would you characterize the support for your work and the facilities you serve from the governance of the Standing Rock Tribe?
We have really great support from our tribal council and our tribal chairman and the programs that we work with at the tribe. I think we have a great relationship with the tribe, and we work well with them. We serve the same people, so we always are collaborating on everything, you know, from transporting a patient or getting a patient home, or, you know, we work with them very well.
You have an interesting status as a group in our country, because you're on a reservation that has a lot of federal connections, but you're in two states. You're in North Dakota and South Dakota. Mm-hmm. Does that create any complications or opportunities for that matter?
It does, because North Dakota has expanded Medicaid and South Dakota does not. So we have to deal with each issue as it comes along. We take it one issue at a time.
Well, does that mean that you might have some South Dakota members coming to North Dakota? I mean, moving to Fort Yates or someplace north
no,
of the border?
No, I think people, they call, when they live in South Dakota, that's their home, and they just have to work around that. We try to work with them to get them the best possible care that we can.
You mentioned that healthcare delivery has changed remarkably in just the last dozen years or so. Mm-hmm. Health records, for example, have migrated from file cabinets to online access, mm-hmm. with the promise, I suppose, of better information for providers and better outcomes for patients. Is that something that your service unit is dealing with?
Yes, we have. Everything's electronic with records, and it puts a lot of requirements on you to review and make sure documentation is accurate. So there's a lot of looking at the documentation to make sure it's correct.
And every tribal member is then, you know, has a good access to that information too?
Well, we are just starting to do that in an Indian Health Service. We have patient health record that is just now becoming accessible, and we are trying to get the word out to patients that you can access your record. You sign up and you can take a look at your own record, and that's an initiative that we are working on currently.
Well, I have been amazed by that in my own life because, you know, you can't remember when you had the shot or something like that.
Yes.
And there it is, you know. You can actually look it up when, at your whim as opposed to calling somebody to have them search through a file. You mentioned you would be studying what other tribes are doing in terms of health care delivery, and you mentioned Alaska. And is there something specific in terms of a place and a program that you're really interested in looking at?
Alaska is one that I'm really interested in because it's a corporation. So all of the health care in Alaska with the tribal communities is all under one corporation. And they have seem to be working really well together as they're all different little groups of people. And all there, some of them are very remote, like some of our people are on Standing Rock. And so I've heard, you know, that they've kind of got through the bumps in the road. And I'm excited to go see how they're doing this. And they do a lot of telehealth. And I want to see how that's working for them. And my understanding is that they have one solid floor that's just devoted to the cultural part of the healthcare, their healthcare needs. And so that's what I'm looking for.
So this is the various tribes that are in Alaska have incorporated as sort of one health unit?
Mm-hmm.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see some possibilities for that in North Dakota because, of course, we have various tribal nations all over the state.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's intriguing. And we look forward to your success in talking with you again after you've completed this two-year Bush Fellowship program. Jana Gipp, congratulations on this wonderful honor.
Thank you very much.
Jana Gipp is a recipient of the 2019 Bush Fellowship Award, and she's also the CEO of the Standing Rock Service Unit, and she lives in Fort Yates, North Dakota. Best wishes to you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next on Main Street, an essay from Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota Pool Trust, offering investment options for people with disabilities that protect eligibility for public benefits. Services available in Minnesota and North Dakota. Learn more at lssmn.org/trusts.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we talk about young George Washington with the author Peter Stark.
Peter Stark lives in Missoula, Montana. He's the author of Astoria, about the aftermath of the Lewis and Clark expedition. This book is about Washington before he became Washington of Mount Rushmore.
The young Washington is ambitious, temperamental, vain, thin-skinned. Well, it goes on.
That's all Peter Stark talking about, this young, uncertain, insecure, but incredibly ambitious Virginian who went out and, incidentally, helped to touch off the French and Indian War.
The 7 Years' War.
It was a world war, and Washington did not know when he made those raids out into the Ohio Valley that he was precipitating one of the first world conflicts.
He wrote to his younger brother Jack and said, "I heard bullets whistle, and believe me, there was something charming in the sound."
To which George II said, "He hasn't heard many bullets then."
Join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Change can bring good. It can also cause loss. That's a bitter truth that distinguished professor of history Tom Ezern explores with today's Plainsfolk essay. He traveled to the other side of the earth to discover how change brought opportunity tinged with sadness. Here's High and Dry at Mount Pisa.
On a sunlit late summer afternoon, we drove up the lane to Mount Pisa, one of the great historic sheep stations of New Zealand, dating from 1859. Over the years, we have made many such calls on agriculturalists of multiple continents. We do so from our base on the Great Plains of North America, which grounds us in farm, community, and history here. Sometimes the stories we find in distant places match up to our experience. Sometimes they surprise us. Sometimes they bring into focus the situation not only in the far place, in this case, the high country of New Zealand, but also here at home. Mount Pisa, now you say it with a long I, not like the city in Italy. Mount Pisa lies on the west side of the Clutha River. It is in the middle of a semi-arid basin that has a history of gold mining, but agriculturally has been devoted mainly to fine wool sheep culture. Until the late 20th century, when the national government brought a great disturbance, a proposal to build a dam or dams on the Clutha, mainly to generate hydroelectric power. This became part of Prime Minister Robert Muldoon's Think Big program for development, an attempt to make a small country a big player in the world economy. Hydroelectric power was supposed to stimulate industrial activity. As this plan formulated in the 1960s and 1970s, Murray and Jackie McMillan, the proprietors of Mount Pisa Station, looked at the survey pegs and were alarmed. They stood to lose all the most productive lands of their station. Eventually, the government backed off and decided to build just one big high dam near the town of Clyde. This resulted in the filling of Lake Dunstan up the Cromwell Gorge and into the Cromwell Basin. It did not touch Mount Pisa directly. At the same time, the Ministry of Works negotiated plans for relocation and mitigation. "They would have liked to have wiped us off the face of the earth and then just moved on," says Murray. But persistent resistance compelled accommodation. Moreover, he observes, "I've got to be extremely honest and say it's one of the best things that ever happened for us. Nimble operators grabbed their settlements and took advantage of changes in the land. Rising water tables meant more water for irrigation. Viticultural and horticultural operations took root. World-class wines emerged. Tourists streamed in. Money was made." Yet the loss was traumatic. Murray recalls returning to the valley while the lake was filling in 1992. "I remember driving up the half-filled gorge with tears running down my face." Despite offsetting economic benefits, he felt deeply the loss of his country town, Loburn, to the lake, and the dismantling of the agricultural community. "He was baptized and married in the Presbyterian church there," he mourns, "but will not be buried there." Jackie says, "We really do miss our farming community because they're like-minded. We have lost our farming community, and because of that, we don't integrate with the cherry and winery people." I ask Murray, "What is your community now?" He says, "I'm not sure we have one." There and here, we know the dynamics of what took place with the destruction of communities on the land as a result of dam building. Perhaps we should reflect on this as metaphor. Just as surely, if not so suddenly, traditional communities across our agricultural regions have diminished or disappeared. We have to ask, what is our community now?
That's Tom Easern. Coming up on Main Street, our regular Friday news briefing from News Director Dave Thompson and another new film review from Matt Olean. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Nearly perfect spring melting conditions have caused the National Weather Service to adjust its spring flood outlook for the Red River Valley. Hydrologist Greg Guss says the slow melt is favorably affecting flood projections, so much so that the worst-case scenario of a 41-foot crest is less and less of a possibility. He says current conditions now point to a 25% chance of a 38.9-foot crest at the Red River at Fargo as its worst-case scenario. Gus says there are still a few variables at play despite the slow melt and no recent precipitation. There is still a lot of snow left to melt and a chance for significant precipitation in the coming days.
Down the road, there's a little more risk for a little more substantial precipitation coming into the area, some of that affecting the northern plains. So we'll be watching to see whether that heavier amount of precipitation is going to be anywhere near affecting the Red River Basin. We could easily have a quarter of an inch or a half an inch or more of precipitation late next week that comes in and around the area. So that's something we have to pay close attention to in the forecast.
High school and college students are a big part of the volunteers responding to fill sandbags in the FM area this spring. In Moorhead, students have been using their open periods to help out. MSUM student Paige Anderson says her memories of the 2009 flood motivated her to volunteer.
It was up like pretty high for in 2009 when I was little. Like I remember being able to like look over the sandbags and be like, this is crazy. It's just kind of like a no-brainer. Like if we can do it, we should do it. Like we don't need to watch Netflix for another 2 hours. We can be here doing something.
Moorhead plans to fill 150,000 sandbags ready for distribution before floodwaters rise. Volunteers are needed at all sites in Moorhead, Fargo, and Cass County. And a building where the roof partially collapsed due to heavy snow at the Red River Valley Fairgrounds in West Fargo will be torn down. Harvest Hall stored more than 60 classic and collector vehicles over the winter. Most have been pulled out over the past few weeks, and there were about a dozen left as of Thursday. Fair General Manager Brian Schultz says once all the cars are out, the building will be demolished.
Make sure that you're not coming out here, and because it is very dangerous up at that building, until we get it tore down, we prefer that nobody comes out and, you know, goes behind the signs. We've got signs up all over that state that, you know, do not enter because it is a very dangerous area.
Schultz says they will decide whether to rebuild the structure in the next couple of months. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I hear a wire machine in the background. It's time to talk to our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us every Friday from his studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
Well, there's a bit of news breaking right now, huh?
There certainly is. It is some movement now. And let me set the stage for you, or let me set the table. The Senate and House had different pay plans for state employees. For example, the Senate has one that would say 2% raises in the first year and 3% in the second year of the upcoming biennium. The House was at 2-2, and there didn't seem to be much movement. However, House Appropriations this morning passed an amendment to one of the spending bills that sets raises at 2 and 2.5%.
Okay.
So they've moved a bit here.
They split the difference.
They split the difference, and I think basically the House is showing that it's willing to move now. So what this means is that there are about 40 spending bills that might have gone to conference committee, that if they can really work out something real close, then there will be a lot less conference committees. And that means maybe a quicker end of the session.
Well, as modest as it might be, it's always nice to see the legislature can compromise on something.
So yeah, they did. Yeah, they can. And you could see that on a few things. I think the logjam might be starting to be broken now.
All right. Well, you're talking with Representative Mike Nathy of Bismarck for your legislative review today. I suspect that a lot of it had to do with money.
A lot of it did have to do with money because that's where we're coming down to. A lot of the policy things have been settled, and not all of them yet, but it is now talking about how much money can you put where and for what projects.
So the legacy fund is a big issue.
The legacy fund is a big issue, and there's that whole thing about creating a new series of buckets for the legacy fund, you know, the legacy fund earnings. Not the principal. Nobody wants to touch the principal of legacy fund, but there is some potential that the earnings for the legacy fund might be even better than were expected. So there might be a movement to get these buckets in place.
Well, and we're talking about something that would be similar to what is done with the money that makes the legacy fund in the first place,
exactly.
The oil tax revenue. Huh?
Right. A lot of things that, you know, basically, when we came to the session, there were a lot of legislators saying we really need to more closely define, A, what the legacy fund itself is going to be used for, and B, what uses are permissible or obvious from the earnings of the legacy fund.
And I see that Brad McAdoll of Williston, a Republican, and Tim Mathern of Fargo, a Democrat, are looking at an idea that for using some of this money for this Theodore Roosevelt proposal, this library.
Right, and that would be to create an endowment fund, not giving the $50 million right up front like the governor wanted, but creating an endowment fund where the money could be going toward upkeep, maintenance of the library and museum when it's built.
So that's one idea for using some of the legacy money.
Exactly. In terms of in the amendment that's being looked at in the Senate, they said this will only happen once we get our priorities funded.
Okay.
And that's another reason for these buckets.
All right. Well, last week we were talking about the Prairie Dog Bill, which has been signed now.
Right.
And now there's a companion bill that didn't fare so well.
It was a bonding bill. And one of the reasons they put it in is because, A, it's going to be a couple of years before the prairie dog bucket fills up. And if you have a bonding bill, well, you can actually borrow and leverage some of the money going forward to start the infrastructure projects right away. Well, it didn't fare very well, probably because of a pretty big price tag. And now I am hearing that there is some negotiations about bringing something back, probably not as rich as was thought, but having some idea and some leverage in terms of bonding.
Now, the prairie dog bill that passed, that was for infrastructure improvement. Was that a quarter of a billion, something like that?
It looks like it's going to be about a quarter of a billion, yes.
And this particular companion, they were looking at a half billion that would actually be bonded, which would mean that the legislature or the state would be, you know, beholden to it.
On the hook for some of it, yes, that's true.
So what they might look at is a smaller number for
that's
that
what
particular?
That's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing a smaller number.
Okay. So we'll see. Might be a pretty good year for infrastructure.
It could very well be.
Higher ed board thing continues to unravel a bit, or ravel, whatever.
It is kind of interesting.
But Don Morton, the Board of Higher Education chairman, spoke up about it in his role as a task force member, not as the chairman, but it's interesting what he had to say.
Right, and he comes out right from the get-go and says, you know, this expanded board from going from 8 board members to 15, that's a 2-board light plan, which I thought was very interesting. And he talked a lot about it, and he's been one who's been on the governor's side for multiple boards. And remember, it was 3 boards at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was 2 boards, but the 2-board thing was killed in the legislature, in the House. And now the expanded board has passed the Senate, and now there's some negotiations in the House about it too. The governor still wants to see a multiple board thing because he said it's going to attract more qualified board members, and maybe some board members who'd like to come back to North Dakota might live out of state and serve on this board and, you know, have one board that focuses on the 2 big research universities and one that focuses on the other campuses.
Meanwhile, this larger board might be, you know, broken down into committees, which would have a similar missions as these 3 boards would have.
Right. And it would all come back to a main board for final action. But one of the reasons why they want to take this bigger board and break it into committees is that there's an awful lot of work for board members. And if you break it into committees, say one assigned to the research universities, well, you can have better oversight of the research universities and maybe have suggestions and be more involved in things.
I was intrigued by the concern brought up by the board's student member, Ashley Thornton, who's going to Williston State College. I thought she had an interesting point to make.
She did. If you're only going to have one student member on the board, that student member, A, doesn't know where he or she is going to be assigned, and B, well, you know, it kind of diminishes the student's voice on the board. That was her conjecture and her opinion on that entire thing. And I have heard that one of the amendments being considered now is to add a second student member who would be a voting member as one of the expanded 7.
Last week we were talking about Bismarck State College becoming a polytechnic higher education institution, 4-year degrees in applied, courses, things
right. that applied science type things
the state needs, like in oil and gas production, that kind of thing. Now we're hearing that Dickinson State University wants to become a dual mission university to kind of incorporate a community college element. Is that it?
That's exactly right. They want to offer certificates or 2-year associate degrees in certain things, and some more projects that are more finely attuned to maybe some of the needs in the Bakken and in the oil industry. And There's broad support for that among the campuses of higher education in North Dakota. Bismarck State College says it'll be a nice symbiotic relationship, which they already have. But, you know, having Dickinson State to be offering some of these associate degree programs and the certificate programs, well, it could be good for Bismarck State College as well.
Could increase the competition for Wahpeton, too, with the
yes,
State College
That's
of
true.
Science.
That's yeah. true.
But they're calling this University Plus, I guess. That's kind of a nice way to put it.
It is.
There's a Senate committee, according to you, that is considering more money for drone research and development, and there's some considerable discussion about how much that should be.
There is considerable discussion, but, you know, there's a proposal to add some more money to the UAS test site, which is based in Grand Forks, to expand it to western North Dakota, maybe Devil's Lake, maybe Minot, maybe Williston, might be Bismarck-Mandan.
So extending its range and probably
extending its range.
The interest in supporting it.
Well, especially now that drones can fly beyond line of sight. They've got that approved.
And we see them now in the sky regularly.
We certainly do.
Where we live. So it's an interesting change. In,
and, you know, talking to the people who are really into this, they're saying that the drones could be a multi-billion dollar industry for a state like North Dakota.
Great.
We've got the open skies.
A great way to diversify.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this teacher probation bill and some of the issues behind it. Danielle Webster reported on this earlier this week.
Right. Now, originally it was going to be 3-year probation, but they reached a compromise and says teachers should be on a 2-year probation. They said 2 years might give you enough time to determine if somebody is qualified to be a teacher in a certain subject area or may need to find something else. And I understand some of the concerns, but there still is some pushback from the education community saying, why are you doing this? Because you should be able to find things out in maybe the first year.
And the element here of probation suggesting, well, if you don't meet certain snuff, you're gone,
right.
As opposed to mentorship, which I think is a more supportive idea. And that's probably something that the teachers' union would be more interested in.
I think you're right, and I think there are a number of legislators who would like to see that explored more too.
Because, of course, the state needs teachers. And
Boy, does the state ever need teachers. That's right.
So this could encourage some teachers or potential teachers to look elsewhere. This is an interesting story to me because I covered this many years ago, and it's now 20 years ago. It's amazing. But Barry Garcia was convicted in 1995 of the murder of Cheryl Tendelin, a West Fargo woman who was in a car in her driveway when this happened. And this was a very, very big case at the time, got a lot of publicity. He was 16 years old when he was sentenced to life in prison.
Without parole.
Yeah.
And he has been trying to convince courts that he should deserve a chance at parole now because, A, you know, he was 16 years old when convicted. B, the first argument is that the U.S. Supreme Court has held that if you're a teen and convicted, you cannot be convicted with life. You know, if you're going to have a mandatory sentence, it can't be life without parole. Now, the prosecutors argue that the sentence that was given Barry Garcia was not mandatory but was discretionary. So they argue that that's one of the reasons why he should not have parole. But in the 2017, the North Dakota legislature passed a bill which said, you know, teenagers should be offered the parole at 20 years. Of incarceration. And that's what was being argued in the Supreme Court this week, is that Garcia's attorney saying he should be allowed to apply for parole.
Because he met that threshold this week.
He did. But the Cass County State's Attorney's Office says, look, this is retroactive, you know, application of a law. When Barry Garcia was given a sentence, that law was not in effect, so it probably does not concern a case like his.
It was a big case then. It's becoming another big case, I guess.
It is.
The Senate has approved a bill ordering evaluations for child abusers. Danielle Webster had this story yesterday.
And this is based out of some things that have happened in, I guess, in the Fargo area and some other parts of the state.
Yeah.
That I don't know how you can put this directly, but it appears that some of these daycare centers may have been employing people who were child abusers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of interesting. Maybe there needs to be better screening. But there is going to be some legislation that looks like it's going to sail through that will kind of tighten the rules on that.
And this would, of course, involve, in this particular case also, parents who would need to be evaluated as to whether they were fit.
That's true, too.
Todd McDonald had a story early this week that the state senate has said no to edible marijuana products despite the support from West Fargo Senator Judy Lee, who said she wasn't fond of edible medical marijuana, but, you know, there are places where people can't smoke.
And you remember the original amendment that was passed on our ballot said edible forms of marijuana were okay. But when the legislature took it over, rewrote the law, they did not allow edible marijuana. Now, there was a real push to allow it again because there are some people who can't smoke it. We know that. But the legislature is not ready to go down that road, at least right now.
Well, we'll end our discussion today with our news director, Dave Thompson, by acknowledging that the weather has been favorable for the spring melt and that the flooding concerns in the eastern edge of the state have been relieved a little bit. We're still on watch. But they're filling a million sandbags in Fargo. Cass County's looking to fill 300,000, Moorhead 150,000, and watching the river because now we're getting into that very sensitive stage where the melt is going to accelerate.
And then what happens if we get more precipitation?
Ouch. Be careful. It's always a pleasure to check in with you, Dave.
Thank you, Doug.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing Nitty Gritty Dirt Band to the Belmehus Auditorium on Thursday, August 8th. You and me go fishing in the dark. Tickets are on sale now at the Bismarck Event Center box office, by phone at 800-514-3849, or online at jadepresents.com or etix.com.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olien. And Matt, you're going to tell us about a movie that's in wide distribution, getting a fair amount of attention, Us, the new Jordan Peele horror film.
So this is Peele's follow-up to Get Out, which won him the screenplay Oscar 2 years ago. And this is more, I would say, more of a typical horror film than Get Out was. Get Out, if you saw it, you know, had elements of horror in it, elements of kind of psychological society analysis. This one, you know, could be any family caught up in a strained situation, but it is the first blockbuster of 2019, probably the first really top-notch film of 2019. He's released it at a perfect time because it's really kind of a dead box office time.
It sure is.
It rang the bell for sure. Now, we can't get into too much of the plot details because there are a lot of big reveals, big surprises, but basically it's about the family that goes to their summer resort and some strange things happen. And they're based on something the mother experienced as a child. The mother is played by Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. The father is played by Winston Duke. And as a child, she got lost in a funhouse at a carnival, at a fairground.
Like mirrored funhouse?
Yes, mirrored funhouse.
That makes sense.
But what happens is she doesn't really see her reflection in the mirror. She sees herself, but it's not a reflection. The self is really alive and there's looking at her.
There's a German word here, doppelganger, kind of important.
So that is a crucial part of it. That's all in the trailer. What eventually happens is four people arrive at their resort and they look exactly like them. It's like the family. What happens from there gets pretty strange. There's a word called the tethered that becomes interesting in this movie that refers to what may or may not be going on. As with any horror film, they're terrorized by this doppelganger family. What's interesting is that Lupita Nyong'o, who plays the part of the mother, her doppelganger is the only doppelganger that can speak. And Nyong'o uses a very strange voice alteration to voice the other character. And this is just a great performance. Her performance just carries this film. It dominates the film. She's so good as the mother and the whatever you want to call this, the shadow, the doppelganger as well. So from there, it becomes your basic horror film. There's a lot of underlying things going on here as well with Peele. He's stated that this may be kind of a treatise on modern society. I don't know that that's really evident when you're watching it. You have to be paying attention or really understanding there might be some subtext going on here. I'm not sure the subtext gets through. That's my one fault of the film, which in a way is good because it's not heavy-handed. It's not banging you over the head with the subtext. But you really have to like look into this deeply to think, okay, is this just a straight horror film or does Peele have something to say about what's going on in America right now?
I think this is fun for actors because they get to play their horror counterparts here.
They do. But Nyong'o's the one who really gets to play her counterpart. Like this film a lot. I think that the tension is palpable throughout. there's a lot of unexpected crime and murdering going on just as you're least expecting it. There's one fantastic scene where it is completely out of left field what's about to happen, and that's a frightening scene as well. So he keeps the tension going. He keeps the frights going, but there are some comic elements. The audience did laugh in a few spots, and that's very typical of a Jordan Peele film. Just like with Get Out, there were comedic elements that the audience was laughing about. I almost like this a little better than Get Out. It's similar but different, but he should be commended. He's really got his finger on the pulse on things right now. Jordan Peele does. Everything he does turns to gold. The acting is good. Elizabeth Moss is in this film. Famous from The Handmaid's Tale, actress Elizabeth Moss. I won't quite tell you what she's doing in the film, but that's an interesting performance as well. It's a little long, but overall I really liked it.
You know, I'm conflicted about films like this because I'm not a horror film fan. Mm-hmm. I don't like to be scared. And the willing suspension of disbelief, I kind of get in there and I get scared.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the skill of a director like Jordan Peele, to kind of keep that, as you mentioned, the word tension, keep us in the story, keep us interested in, oh my God, is something awful going to happen? And
what Peele seems to have figured out, Doug, is to make a horror film, but also to make a commentary on social mores, society, politics, whatever. He's able to kind of pull off both. And I think that kind of elevates films like Get Out and Us from maybe what they would be normally as just, you know, slasher films or horror films or alternate reality films. So he's clearly perfected this. There are some amazing shock things and secrets that are revealed in the second half of the film. People are talking about what it means, what's the purpose of the ending, what does that mean? So you're going to have to go and find out for yourself. But I would recommend this to adults, and teenagers are going to like it as well.
I would think that editing is an important piece of – well, it's an important piece of any film. But for a horror film, you know, cutting it at just the right spot and all that.
It is crucial to horror films. And I think what's going to make these Peele films last beyond a few years is that they seem like they're very prescient. They seem like they're very current. I think The Exorcist is a film that doesn't hold up anymore. I've seen it a couple times since its release, and I think these films will probably hold up a little longer. That's my guess. But Lupita Nyong'o, she's already getting awards buzz for this performance. Oh. It might be too early in the year for her to sustain that buzz through the end of the year and get an Oscar nomination for Best Actress, but she's tremendous in this movie. The promise we saw in 12 Years a Slave, which is where she won the Oscar, of course, is definitely demonstrated here.
Well, it's time for an Oscar trivia question for Matt Olien. And this is another one from Doug Zenter, who works here at Prairie Public. He just gave me a list that was intriguing, so here's number three for you. The big five in the Academy Awards are Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay. What was the first film to win the big five? And there's a follow-up here.
It Happened One Night, 1934.
And who won the Best Director?
Clark Gable was the Best Actor. Claudette Colbert, Actress, and Frank Capra was the Director. I'm not sure. Was it Robert Riskin who wrote the screenplay?
Yes, it was. All right. So there you go. What other films have done the same thing since?
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest in 75, Silence of the Lambs in 91.
Hit it right out of the ballpark. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the North Dakota recipients of the 2019 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2019 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
On the next episode of Threshold, this is what it sounds like to walk on one of the two great ice sheets remaining on the planet.
It's a pretty interesting surface with this honeycomb. I mean, half of what we're walking around on is not ice, it's whole.
Join us on the Greenland Ice Sheet next time on Threshold.
Threshold, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming up Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 29th. Fred Kenworthy had a big idea. He would take a small wagon pulled by dogs all the way around the world, starting in Grand Forks. The year was 1896, and Fred, or F.G., attempted the trip without a cent in his pockets. That was not a good idea. Fred was a 30-year-old tailor who owned a small business in Grand Forks. There were plenty of stories in newspapers in that era about globetrotters. Journalist Nellie Bly traveled around the earth in 72 days in 1889, and George Griffiths did it in 64 days in 1894. Mark Twain started a global trip in 1895, but Kenworthy's likely inspiration was Annie Londonberry of Boston, who completed an 1895 bicycle tour of the globe, earning $5,000 along the way through lectures, advertisements, and exhibitions. To prepare for his attempt, Kenworthy trained a team of massive Newfoundland dogs, Rex, Bingo, Mac, Nero, Pocahontas, and Rover. Each weighed 150 pounds and were claimed to be as strong as ponies. They would pull a lightweight sleigh on snow and later a small wagon on roads. Kenworthy left his business and convinced his friend, Harry Whitnall, to accompany him. Both got passports, planning to journey east from Grand Forks to New York, then by steamer to England, followed by the principal cities of Europe, then on to Asia, Hawaii, and then home to North Dakota. All did not go as planned. As reported in the Minneapolis Tribune on this date in 1896, Kenworthy's outfit had just started out from Grand Forks without a cent, but with hearts full of optimistic vim. Traveling in easy stages, the dog team went to Fargo and then headed toward St. Cloud. Unfortunately, April 1st brought a snowstorm with snow too deep for the easy sleigh pulling. Frantic, Kenworthy bought a toboggan, but the snow was too soft even then. So Fred, Harry, and the dogs walked the last 65 miles to Minneapolis. It got worse when Harry sprained an ankle and had to take the train. The dogs were dog-tired upon reaching Minneapolis, and so hungry they ate $3.50 worth of beef. They were entirely exhausted, and so was Kenworthy. Out of money, out of hope, and out of luck, Fred gave up the round-the-world-by-dog team quest. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
After a week of claiming political victories, President Trump set his sights again on the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Plus, a tale of two IPOs, Lyft and Levi's. And a new Broadway show, part civics lesson, part memoir.
This play is like a love letter to my mom.
A look at what the Constitution means to me. All this and more Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday on Main Street, author Deborah Courtney joins us to discuss her new memoir, I Am a Stranger Here Myself. Her book interweaves her own story with the story of Narcissa Prentice Whitman, the first pioneer missionary to cross the Rocky Mountains, arriving in what is now Washington State in 1836. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend this Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.